Ladies and gentlemen, Darren from Google is in the house, and I'm really excited and honored, privileged to have a Googler, you know, coming onto the podcast. And Darren, say hi to everybody. Tell us how you're doing and which part of the world are you residing in right now and what's going on in your city?
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm based out of Singapore and I guess like many people around the world, working from home right now. So spending a lot of time on video calls, but I love to do this sort of thing because it sharpens the mind and gives me some intellectual stimulation, and I always get as much from these sessions as I give. So looking forward to today.
This is brilliant. I think seeing action is what's important right now for everyone who's working from home like you and me, right? So we're definitely going to talk a little bit about our working from home experience, especially, you know, the Google culture as well. You know, the news that you guys have extended until June, I think, next year, for employees to continue to work from home, right? So we'll talk a little bit about that later on. Tell us, you know, for the audiences, well, I'm familiar with what you do because I'm quite familiar. I follow your posts on LinkedIn. I read your blogs as well, especially, you know, you share a lot of insights about, you know, digital banking, especially in the customer experience area. So maybe tell us, you know, what you do in your day job and introduce yourself to our audience as well.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So I guess a bit of background, because I think my accent's a bit blurred these days. I'm originally from the UK. I grew up there sort of around the Cambridge area, and like most people in the UK, went towards London to work. And then I realized, man, this is pretty tough. Like the rat race is not necessarily for me, and I wanted the opportunity to travel. And so then that took me to the sunny shores of Dubai, and I was in the Middle East for the best part of 10 years, traveling all around, but mainly based in Dubai. So I was there during the, you know, the real boom times. I was there in some tough times, and you know, a lot of great experiences, both personally and professionally. And then I find myself now in Southeast Asia, based out of Singapore, and I've been here for the last 7 years, so you know, nearly 17 years as an expat. So I always get asked where is home, and I'm still trying to figure that out. In terms of my day job, so I work in Google, specifically Google Cloud, and I focus on digital transformation. And I get a bunch of people that say to me, hang on a minute, is that kind of code for you really want to push cloud? Or, you know, why is a digital transformation guy sitting in a cloud company? And really it comes from the fact that Google wants to drive business outcomes for our customers. You know, it's not just that we want to sell our products or our technology. We want to help people drive more revenue, help them be better around operations, help them be more profitable, help them have better staff and employee engagement, help them drive better experiences for their customers. And so what I focus on is really that business end of the transformations. And then I'm very fortunate that behind me is this fantastic suite of Google and Alphabet businesses that are truly experts in their respective areas. And so we go together to these opportunities where relevant. You know, we don't push our products for the sake of it. And, you know, each of the Google and Alphabet businesses has phenomenal capabilities, ginormous scale, years and years of experience that we try to impart upon the customers with our preaching. We just want to share with them, here's the things that have worked for us, many things have not worked, and see if we can do some world-changing things together and ultimately help society, help people, and you know, do some really interesting things.
This is really fantastic. I think that's probably one of the best intros I've ever heard in the show. You know, I've been doing this for nearly 100 episodes so far, so definitely we're excited, you know, to have a Googler, you know, coming onto the podcast, and we've experienced this around the world, especially, you know, in Middle East, right? You mentioned, especially in Asia, and now you're based in Singapore. The first question I'm gonna, you know, shoot at you is how do brands and businesses in the East, where we are residing in, you know, implement customer experience versus the West that brings the innovation and the blueprint, right? Obviously. So, what are some of your successful verticals and organizations that you have helped to help perform those in the West? What can the East teach the West?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, I guess most people would say that the West stole a march on innovating a little earlier than the East. You know, they had some technology foundations and, you know, infrastructure maturity that helped for sure, undoubtedly. And so, you know, I think many people would agree that they were a little earlier in many things. I think there are lots of lessons learned from the West because they went earlier, things that worked, things that didn't work. And then when I always look to the East, you know, there's this desire in most markets, I mean, differs by market, to kind of leapfrog what I would call sort of intermediate stages of maturity, where the West took this kind of linear step towards maturity, step by step by step, continually over the last 2-3 decades, improving things. You know, if the East does that, they'll always be 2-3 decades behind. And I'm absolutely seeing an entrepreneurialism, a desire, a drive in terms of investment at a government and a corporate level to skip ahead. And so I've seen this, you know, kind of light speed catch up from the East. And, you know, that's a kind of interesting kind of parallels in terms of the speed they've moved at. I honestly feel like, you know, many markets in the East, there's more of an entrepreneurial foundation. Like I see more teenagers starting businesses, you know, and it may not be the big business that makes them rich, but there's just this fearlessness in the market. There's a ton of investment here. There's even kind of at the educational institutions now, there's courses you can study to be better at, you know, product development, entrepreneurialism, fintech, you name it. And governments in this part of the world really, really supporting the creation of these new startups, whether it's fintech or health tech, etc. And I'm not saying the West doesn't do that, but I've not seen the volume and the amount of support that I see here. And there's just phenomenal talent all over the place. So I see this sort of fearlessness here. I see this view that I'm not necessarily going to go into a corporate career, or maybe I'm going to have 5 careers. I'm going to have a corporate job, and I'm going to have a fintech job, and I'm going to have a podcasting gig like you, for example, and I'm just going to have this really varied work-life balance, and it's not going to be like a 9-to-5 single job that I keep for a long time. And I think that's true to a large extent globally, but I feel like it's more true and more accentuated in the East. And so I see this just crazy pace of catch up. And that's even, you know, excluding China. I think China is another level of investment and an ability to pull on talent at a scale that's maybe never been seen before. And they're looking at where they can differentiate. And when you look at the tech platforms, when you look at the digital banks, that's like another story all again. But even outside of China, you know, I'm really impressed with what's going on in Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, and that's not to mention Singapore, my home location. I just think each place is doing something a little bit different from the other, but huge amounts of investment, a fearlessness, and I wouldn't even say a desire to catch up the West. I'd say now they're at that stage where, how can I do something groundbreaking that's never been done before, offer an experience that's beyond what's out there? And I don't think you could say that 5 years ago, because I think many of these markets were still sort of looking to track or compete with the West. And so I think it's really exciting times. And to be fair to the West, I don't want to sort of suggest that's a legacy environment. I think they can and are in many cases learning from what's going on in the East. The best example I give is, you know, in my opinion, the concept of the super app really originated in the East. And there are many Western firms that are starting to learn, you know, what that looks like from a technology and an experience standpoint. And when is a super app relevant and when is it not? You know, there are pros and cons. And so I think it's a really fascinating time. And I think more than anything, I just love the amount of innovation that's going on right now. Yeah, you know, we're in a tough time globally because of what's going on with the pandemic, but I'm just blown away by the amount of investment, the amount of passion and entrepreneurialism that's come out during this really tough time. And so I'm excited for the coming years.
This is great. I think that's the reason why you're anchored in Asia, right? And you're seeing more action in Asia because especially you mentioned about the fintech. In the digital banking arena, there's a lot of exciting new developments. And we have already seen so many great digital banking innovations around this part of the world. So one area that I think that is right in the middle of that disruptive storm right now is retail banking especially. So it's been coming on for some time, and we've seen a trend towards even consumers like me, right, shifting to digital solutions in general. We don't queue up at the banks anymore. The mobile phone basically, completes every transaction for us. I'm using those apps, 24/7 these days. So I remember that Bill Gates famously said that the banking is necessary, but banks are not. Back in 1994, I think. So he has got a few things right over the years, but do you think this is one of them, in your opinion? Do you think that we will still keep most of our savings and good old-fashioned, transactions with all these traditional banks? Who are banks looking to target with digital solutions these days?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, far be it from me to say that Bill Gates got it wrong, because he's been more right than wrong, I feel, over the years and done some incredible work. But I guess, like a decade on, the reality is there's still most banks in place and we haven't really displaced banking truthfully yet. So I think maybe he was a little early with that comment, but I do feel like we will still see a lot of disruption in that space, and banks are going to need and are needing to transform to stay relevant. So maybe he was just a bit early with that comment. Let me put it to you as a great indicator and a preface to a bit more of my answer. Do you wake up in the morning and ever say, gee, I wish I could go to my bank? Or do you ever wake up in the morning and go, I wish I had a better relationship with my bank manager? Do you say that?
Sometimes they drive me nuts. So especially, with bank managers, right, it's important sometimes to having to bang on the table to get things done, right? Or to waive off certain charges, especially, yeah.
I had one of those today, actually, with my investment bank. But, by and large, I'm a big believer that, we wake up in the morning, and depending on your life stage and your sort of relationship and financial situation, we think about going from one place to another, and certainly pre-COVID we did, like, I need to get a taxi, I need to get a plane, I need to transport myself somewhere. We think, I want to improve my financial situation, I want to provide health care for my family, I want to provide for my children. So I think there's these six or seven drivers that we have every day that, generally speaking, come before any desire to have a better relationship with our bank or our insurers, etc. And so I think the winners in this particularly financial services race will be the ones that can find ways to embed themselves in our daily life journeys. Like when I'm buying something, whether it's on an e-commerce site or however I'm buying it, maybe I want financial services options around that, but I don't want to skip out of my e-commerce experience and go to my banking app. I certainly don't want to call up the bank and say, hey, can you give me some money over here, please? I want it to be seamless. I want it to be embedded. And so I really like, there's a bank here, DBS, I really like, for the longest time they've said they want to make banking invisible, and I love that, because I frankly, as a customer, I want banking to be invisible, right? I want to do the banking, I want it to be safe, I want it to be reliable. To your point, I want it to work, I want it to be frictionless, but I don't really want to see my bank in that process. If I'm doing an e-commerce transaction, I want to go on there and have the search experience, which I want to be very good. When I want to pay for it, I want the payment experience, whether I'm paying for it up front, like credit card, or whether I'm paying for it in some sort of buy now, pay later scheme. Whatever it is, I want it to be done in the solution. I want it to be seamless, quick. I want the journey to be great. And I just want my product, right? I don't sort of feel like there's a need to skip out of that and have six extra steps because, my bank dictates that that's how it should work. And so I'm a big believer that the firms that can make themselves somewhat invisible and or embed themselves in our daily life journeys will be the ones that will win.
That's fantastic. I think you've painted this, illustrated this really well, especially in terms of how these solutions are kind of not just change the game, right? It's already part and parcel of everybody's digital life. And what exactly are these banks actually looking to target at? Are they looking still at, Gen Z and millennials who maybe are not so, people who are flush with cash? Or are they sticking to a traditional Gen X and baby boomers who are maybe the more profitable segments for these banks?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've done a lot of consulting studies on this, and I don't think there's one answer, to be honest. And you know, there shouldn't be one answer, because if there's one answer, that means every bank's going after the same set of customers, and that's not healthy and not sustainable. You know, in fairness to the banks, we want them to be sustainable. We want them to make money so that they're around to continue to innovate. So we want them to focus on different areas. And so, you know, I can think about, like you said, there's the Gen X, there's the millennials, there's the baby boomers, etc. But outside of that, there's obviously, you know, focusing on business banking, small, medium enterprises, etc. There's focusing on students. So I think there's many different areas they can focus on. You know, and historically people have said, you know, maybe, you know, the Gen Zs or the millennials are not profitable, etc., because it's typically the people that are more advanced in life that have more money. But the reality is, even millennials to a degree, but definitely Gen Z, they've grown up with digital platforms, right? Like, they are so used to using digital services, digital payments, social media. And so whilst they might not be the most profitable segment, if you don't hook them when they enter the working world, when they start to use your services, then later on the cost to acquire them and the effort to acquire them when they do have money and when they are more affluent, it's really tough. And that's what traditional banks have always struggled with. So I think whichever your segment is that you're going after, you have to take a longer term view as the sort of life cycle of people kind of occurs and they become hopefully more affluent, as society does. You have to acquire them way before they want those major life events like a mortgage or a car loan or money for a wedding or whatever the major life event is. Because if you acquire them before, then they trust you when we get to that life event. You've got to find a way through digital channels and digital technologies to reduce down the cost to operate and therefore the costs that you pass on to your customers dramatically. And it's still a crowded marketplace because there's a lot of banks around the world, whether it's legacy banks, fintech solutions, new banks. You've got just payment solutions, for example, that have sort of a very narrow offering, but they're biting at a chunk of the traditional banking ecosystem. So you've got all of these players now. And so I add on to this, as well as being great at customer experience and throttling down cost and being very targeted, you just got to offer a phenomenal differentiated experience. And some of that comes back to business model as well. Where will you make your money? Will you make money in a traditional way? And if we look at big tech firms, whether it's in China or the rest of the world, they've kind of challenged the model of making money. If we look at ride hailing, for example, they make money in a very different way to how you would traditionally make money if you were a taxi company, for example. And so, you know, you can say the same for Netflix or Spotify or even many of the Google businesses. So I think the ones that will win will be a combination of hyper-targeting, phenomenal customer experience, being data-driven, and a very different business model. And I think you've got to put all of that together. If you just have tech and targeting without a unique business model, it's too easy to copy that. People will come along next week, next month, particularly in scale markets like China, they will copy it within 5 minutes. And so to defend, you have to have something unique as a business model. And I think that's where firms will win or lose.
That's fantastic. I think I agree with you 100%, especially when it comes to experimenting and testing you know, innovations as well. That's really important to continuously change and adapt and to grow, right? So we know that you're leading, you know, a lot of digital transformation initiatives across Asia. So while digitalization has arguably, you know, never been more important than it is today, is there enough buy-in from businesses, especially in Asia, from what you observed?
Well, I'd say there's more buy-in now than there was pre-COVID, because so many of the sort of legacy bricks and mortar businesses, if you like, have had to very rapidly shift to serving customers digitally. And, you know, if they're being very honest, they've kind of, during this COVID period, had to put a band-aid on things and quickly stand up digital solutions. And so I think we'd all admit there's an opportunity to do that better if we've done it quickly during this period. But, you know, needs must, and we need to keep our businesses running and keep our staff paid and continue to service our customers. But for many of those businesses, they're looking at, I don't want to be caught in this situation again. I need to shift properly in this direction. So there's many of our customers that are saying, you've helped me with the Band-Aid solution, you've helped me stand up tactical digital solutions, but when we get beyond this, how do I shift more radically so this is the norm for me? How do I take out some costs and shift my mindset and my talent and my operating model to work this way? There's also a whole bunch of sort of cynics that previously didn't think digital was a big thing and they could cling on to their traditional business model. And I think I was talking to a customer in the telco space the other day and they were like, we've actually really proven that we can do this and we can move fast and we can exist in this new world and operate efficiently. And so, you know, we were cynical about it before, but now we really want to take this leap and embrace it fully. And so help us on that journey through the rest of the way. And so I think historically there's been lots of people say, I want to do this, but probably weren't ready for it or didn't quite see a compelling event to actually do it because it takes investment, it takes time, it takes perseverance. And now what we're seeing is people saying, sadly, COVID has been that compelling event. Sadly, COVID has impacted our revenues or our profitability. Sadly, COVID has impacted our ability to collaborate the way we would. And so we now have this compelling event. Let's go, go, go and speed up. And what might have been a 5 or a 3 year program before, we're seeing customers saying, how can I do this in 2 to 3 years rather than 3 to 5 years? And so I think there's more urgency than ever right now. I also think there've been some firms, maybe globally, but I guess this is where my time and body is in Asia now. I certainly see a lot of people in Asia that have seen phenomenal opportunities to take advantage of people shifting online and working from home a lot. And so we've seen some really creative solutions. And, the best example I give is, pre-COVID, I personally never did anything around sort of health tech and online health checks and talking to a doctor online. It just didn't exist for me, right? I was pretty traditional in that I booked an appointment and went to see a doctor. And I don't know how much of that has shifted online now to kind of online appointments and online diagnosis and just prescriptions being delivered, etc. But I guarantee it's not going back to zero. I guarantee that's a market that's here to stay now to some degree. And I love that. I love that we've evolved through a sense of need and urgency, but we've also learned it kind of works. And so some degree of that will stay and we'll just continue to build on what that can be for the future. And I'm not saying that doctors will be eradicated because I'm a big believer that you need that tried and tested practitioner. But if we can layer on an experience around them and have it driven by AI and have the combination of experts with AI in any of these fields, then I think that's a step in the right direction. So I'm excited for what's coming in the coming months and the next 12 to 18 months as hopefully we navigate this storm in terms of the pandemic and not even just go back to normal, but go back to what we can be in the future based on what we've seen we can achieve during these tough times.
I'm with you on that one, especially someone who has recent health setbacks, right? Like going to visit a doctor, especially scheduling appointments is a nightmare. And then having to organize so many different appointments, right? Especially if you have a team of doctors taking care of every inch of your body, you have a team of doctors and different appointments and different locations to go to, like tele-doctor or online doctor services, these are like godsend. So once you have, actually experienced that, you don't want to go back to the old way. So I'm with you on that. And earlier on, you mentioned something about super apps. It's a topic that is really close to my heart as well. I love apps that have more than just one feature or one useful function. I love the fact that you can order the transport, order food, groceries. You can make e-payments, using just one app without having to like download and install like a plethora or maybe dozens of apps just to, get one thing done, for example. So in the days or in this, day and age where, we're talking about super apps that are greatly popular in Asia, especially in China, right, which I think they pioneered this as well as the ecosystem. Everyone is like building or developing, to become like a Google Play Store themselves or like to become their own Apple App Store, for their own niche audience or their own segments. Do you predict like more of these bigger platforms, more channels, more apps in the ecosystem and maybe even more integration is going to be the way moving forward, or is going to continue like separate apps in the West, where we have Facebook and Amazon having different apps for messaging, different apps for social media, and different apps for e-commerce and shopping, for example. How do brands or organizations or businesses continue to enhance brand loyalty and customer experience with these super apps?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if a customer were asking me this today, wherever they were based, should I build a super app? I guess my initial answer is, let's look at what's in your product suite today, and let's look at where you see your product direction going and where you see your firm going. And, you know, maybe the answer is that you are, you know, a one product firm and you do it really, really well. And I don't necessarily think the answer is always to add on another six products just so you can become a super app, you know, like, because there's a danger that you build the other five or six bolt-ons really badly and you degrade your customer experience and you distract yourself from this cash cow that is your core business. You know, maybe actually in that case there's a benefit to layering on features and investment and changing the business model around what you already have. So I don't think it's a given that super app is for everybody. What I will say is, between the East and the West, one thing I see is a difference in choice. And so in the West, if I think about food delivery or e-commerce or even ride hailing, for example, there's a lot of choice depending on what market you're in, like many, many, many choices. And so I see this tendency when I talk to my friends there that they quite like having the different apps because they enjoy the choice. And so they have a firm that they like to shop with online for electronics. They have another firm they like to shop with for something else. They have a particular firm they like to use for ride hailing. They have a firm they like to use for food delivery. And so at least the people I talk to in the West, they love the choice. And by and large, all of those choices are pretty good quality and innovative business models. And, you know, it's not like there's a great option in terms of price or customer experience and then the rest are terrible. And so, you know, I find they enjoy having the extra apps. And then you come to the East, and I think depending on markets, there's just not the same amount of choice. If I look at any one of the Asian markets, there's typically one or two, at most three major e-commerce players. So often sort of one or two, really. If I look at ride hailing, there's kind of one or two, and then there's a local taxi service. And so I think there's not the same choice of high quality businesses that, you know, focus in this very specific area. And so I absolutely believe that's why in the East we're seeing more of these brands that we already know and love. They've got our mind share. They provide us with such core daily life journeys. I keep using that expression, like the things I do in my natural daily life, they're already servicing one or two of them. And so it's a natural extension for them to say, well, I'm helping you with ride hailing. I'm helping you with food. You know what, I'm going to try and help you with how you do your shopping as well, like your e-commerce. You know, like it's just a natural extension for them. And so I think through lack of choice and this strong brand power that some of the super apps have in the East, it's kind of a natural journey for them. I think it's really hard for a newer firm, even in the East, to try and recreate that, because you need critical mass. You need people on the platform. You need a big user base. If you set up a ride hailing firm tomorrow and, you know, you're trying to get your first 1 million customers, which is no small number, right? Like in any other world, you'd love 1 million customers using your ride hailing firm, but that would be tiny in this part of the world. It would kind of not make obvious sense to say, well, while I'm getting that user base of 1 million customers, I'm going to add on a food service and I'm going to add on this, because you'd end up spreading yourself too thin and probably not doing any of them really, really well. We've got to go back to innovation first principles, which is provide something unique and differentiated where you have an experience or some IP or something that's patentable or protected that you do better than anybody else. And I think there's a danger of like doing too many things and not doing them well. And so I think we won't see every firm coming up with super apps, but the really large, phenomenally engineered firms that have a big user base, whatever industry they're in, they have an opportunity to do more and to look at adjacent opportunities. Adjacent, whether that's in a super app, it doesn't have to be in a super app, right? There are many, if you think about the Google businesses, many of them are not in one app, right? We have separate businesses that exist independently. but they're all really exciting big digital businesses. So I don't think it always has to be super app either. And I think there are, you know, benefits to having things separate sometimes. So, you know, long answer, and I'm going to come up with a very consulting answer, which is it's what's right for your business. But I think the East will continue to lead the West in terms of super app development and lessons learned.
It's what's right for your business. I think that's a brilliant answer. And, you know, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that, you know, the digital transformation expert from Google is here on my podcast. So I'm definitely going to ask you, you know, how much of digital transformation is technology and how much of it is about culture and mindsets?
Look, I could get five buddies in a bar and debate this, and I suspect we'd come out with 75 different answers.
You only have 5 minutes.
Yeah. The truth is, I think that we as an industry have solved a lot of the technology problems that are on us today. I mean, there'll always be new challenges, but yeah, if I look at the digital brands that we know and love, depending on which region you're in, if you like Spotify, if you like Netflix, if you like Grab, you know, whatever the digital brand is that you love, the technology they employ is not particularly proprietary to them. They use cloud, they use machine learning, they use AI, sometimes they use IoT, etc. But all of that is available. You and I could start a business today and we could already be in the cloud. We could already have access to machine learning, like, straight away. And so, you know, the beauty of these cloud providers is they've democratized these services and they've made them at your fingertips and sort of uniform. So we could access the same capabilities that Spotify does right now if we got our credit cards out and started it. So I have to say it's not the technology that's the differentiator. Now, I do say I don't think you can be an amazing digital brand without having a really strong technology foundation. You know, it would be a little weird for you to be a digital bank and you're not good at tech. You know, like, that's just, the two don't go together. How could you run an app and not have good, reliable, fast tech, as an example? But for me, there's a few other components to it. You need a unique business model. I keep coming back to this. If I'm going to build and I make it exactly the same as Monzo or Starling, why should people use me? And at some point, because I'm starting later than Monzo and Starling, I'm probably behind the curve. And so I have to change the game up with something in terms of how I make money or how I raise money or how I service customers or which customers I go after. I've got to do something unique around that business model. And that's easier said than done, to be honest. There's a lot of people that say, I'm an innovation person, I'm creating a new startup. Truly a unique business model is an art more than a science, I believe. And then let's not ignore the culture, talent, org aspect to this, because if you have a legacy approach to org, like if you have silos, if you have a sort of, if you're in banking and you have this, there's a business team and a tech team and other support teams, if you have that mindset, like that us and them mindset, you're never going to collaborate like a startup will, like a big tech firm will, like the Chinese tech players do. And so I think it's really important that you think what you want your culture to be like. You know, I'm a big believer you don't just want the leaders, the CEO, to come up with all the great ideas. You want the ideas to come bottom up and flesh up from everywhere so you can crowdsource ideas, because I don't have a monopoly on great ideas. Nobody does. And you want people to act like owners and have autonomy and be constantly innovating and almost have this paranoia around, we need to keep challenging ourselves to make our products better. And with all of that chaos going on, because we're moving so fast and we're trying out new things, there's guaranteed to be some politics and some friction. And so how can we create an environment where we're okay with friction and we're okay with politics? It's going to happen, but we just talk it out and we behave in a respectful way. And I respect you and you respect me and we respect our different skills and cultures and backgrounds, etc. And so how can we have this constant foundation of us treating each other the way we want to be treated? And so I've said a lot of things, but you can imagine I'm strongly a believer that it's so much more than just technology. You need to have a good foundation there, but tech alone is not going to give you a winning startup or a winning digital experience.
Very well put, and I 100% agree with you on that as well. It's not just about the technology. So moving the conversation to a bigger question around society, government's encouragement of contact tracing apps in the fight against COVID-19 has thrown open the question of public health versus data privacy. Like in Singapore, right, we are even issued tokens that look like Apple AirPods, right? And we have to carry that around, in the next few months to come in order to even enter a cinema, for example. Do you think this is the right balance in terms of public health versus data privacy? A right balance can be found?
It's interesting because we're bringing together two really hot topics right now. Obviously, there's sort of an emotive aspect around the pandemic and how it's sadly making people sick and obviously impacting our freedoms, etc. And then there's this whole other topic that existed pre-pandemic around data privacy, data security, how firms should use the data, etc. I think in this unique situation where we need to get better together, whether we need to heal medically and economically, I think that it's appropriate that we have these solutions. I do think we need to be careful as countries around what we will do with the data and how we'll secure the data and what we will do with the data when it's all done. I think we're in an unusual situation where people are willing to give up more data and trust more data to be given out right now than they normally would. So I think governments will have to think about how does that work at the end of this. Like, I think it's probably not appropriate we just carry on having contact tracing apps forever. I think there's a time when, we need to phase those out. And I really think governments need to think beyond contact tracing around what do I do to make sure that firms as a whole, including Google, are acting appropriately around data. What data should we gather? How do we secure it? How can it be used? How can it be monetized? And I think it's a tough balance because us as consumers, we want great experiences. I want my e-commerce provider or my bank to give me something relevant and timely. And the reality is that generally comes from knowing me and knowing my data to some degree. And so it's a fine balance. A lot of it for me is trust, and it's less about the terms and conditions, what Google writes or Amazon writes, etc. And it's more about how they behave and how I think they act around my data. When I start to see things that are inappropriate, or I start to get spam, or I think they're overselling to me, for example, or they're picking up things that they've seen elsewhere that are somewhat personal to me and they're using it to try and sell me more, that's when I start to get uncomfortable. And so I think countries need to work with all manner of technology companies to say, here's our ideas around how we solve these things. I think technology companies have a part to play in this because we are the experts in theory, and I don't just mean Google, I mean the industry. We need to help governments with how can we secure these things? How can we continue to give Darren a great experience and give him opportunities to do things that help him in his daily life journeys? Again, I use that phrase. But how can we do that in a way that we respect what he wants and respect the laws in the country and give him freedom of choice around not subscribing to those services and turning things off and even potentially getting data out at the right time? And so I think there's this journey we need to go on even beyond COVID that says, how can we get that right? I don't think we're there today. And I think it's got to be a combination of customers giving us feedback when we do things wrong in any industry, any country, any company, and technology companies investing proactively with a genuine desire to get this right, and countries at a government level saying, work with us to get this right together. And you know what, we're going to have mistakes along the way, we're going to learn things. I think as long as there's a genuine intent to do the right thing and we have the checks and balances in place, then I think we'll move in the right direction. And I think there's a lot of work to be done on that. It's a hot topic, and I spend a lot of my time talking about how Google is committed to trying and get it right. We're not there yet as much as we'd like to be. And I think it's a journey for all firms and the industry.
Absolutely. I think it's like what you put it so well. It's a continuous process, and we'll just continue achieve a right balance. I will definitely, not going to get this 100% right immediately, but it's going to be something that will make a refinements and gradual improvement as we progress along and adapt to this post-COVID world as well. In fact, post-COVID, do you expect trust in technology to increase post-COVID?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I pick up the newspaper every day, and there's a complaint about data with one company, or there's a complaint about privacy or services and behaviors, etc. And like, because tech is so prevalent every day, there's something in the news around that. However, when I meet my friends, they sort of tell me, particularly in COVID, they couldn't have survived without the digital solutions that, you know, we've touched upon earlier, whether it's e-commerce or ride hailing or, you know, video calls, etc. And so whilst I think there will still remain this concern around how we deal with data, I think there is a trust that these firms and these solutions are an embedded part of our daily lives now, and we do rely on them, and they are pretty reliable. You know, these services haven't gone down too much during these times. So I think there's trust in the sense it's there when I need it, it does what I need it to do, it gives me what I need. I think the key is, and me as a consumer, I think I trust the solutions. I just want you to behave the right way. And as long as you behave the right way, then I trust you. And I think intrinsically, I'm somebody that trusts. And then if you lose my trust, it's very hard to get it back. And I think about sort of friendships or solutions. And I think that way. And we can all so easily lose our customers' trust. So I think there's a kind of trust intrinsically at the moment, but you can very easily lose it. And I think we can't be complacent, we can't rest on our laurels, because people have been dependent on these solutions. We have to say, how do we prevent ourselves from losing this trust? How do we be proactive in saying, we need to make sure Darren feels comfortable with how we're behaving around his data, how we're securing things, how we're marketing to him, how we're targeting him. And I think we all need to be proactive around these things, whether you're a fintech or a big tech or a bank looking to pivot. I think that's the key. Right now, we still have some trust. People are very reliant on us, but you can lose it so quickly. And if you lose it right now in these fragile times where people are, you know, having tough times and working from home and balancing childcare and managing finances and health, etc., you know, this is a time where if you lose it, I'm not sure you're getting it back. And so I think this is a really pivotal time where we'll have people that stand out and do the right thing. Sometimes even at the sacrifice of revenue and growth, they'll do the right thing because it's the right thing to get the reliability and the security and the customers feeling comfortable with where we are. And I think that's what we've got to do. We've got to put customers first. We've got to build the trust in conjunction with them. We're going to get some things wrong, and we need to react on that feedback very quickly and be seen to own up when we get things wrong and show how we're getting it right, because we've learned from these lessons.
This is definitely very heartening to hear. And before we let you go, it's already nearing 45th minute mark, so I apologize, you know, for dragging this on past the half hour mark, but because this has been such an effortless podcast to do together with you, just one last question. Yeah, everyone knows that in terms of workplace spotlight, Google always gets it right, especially when it comes to company culture. So my question to you is that in terms of working from home, like what you and I are doing right now, how does Google and the employees like you adapt to this new normal? And in terms of like companies that are trying to get their workforce back to the office right now, but employees aren't really embracing the idea of returning to the office just yet. So what's your hot take on that?
Yeah, I guess the first thing I would say to pick up on something you said is in Google, we don't go in with the assumption like we're generally getting things right. We, you know, we're constantly looking at how we can enhance culture and org and ways of working, etc. There's entire teams dedicated to just continually learning about how we can do that better, even during this time. I, as somebody that's pretty much joined Google during the virus, I had a few days in the office, but not many. I feel really fortunate that I joined this company that naturally was very distributed because of the global nature of the firm, the global nature of the businesses, and it just seems so common to the Googlers to work in a distributed manner. I'm very lucky that our tools, in my opinion, are very good, and they allow us to work unencumbered because they're generally online. You know, they're not sort of offline tools. That's just the nature of Google. I think what I really appreciate more than the tools themselves is it would have been very easy for the Googlers to forget about me as a new joiner and to not wrap their virtual arms around me and try and make me feel part of the team. And it's been completely the opposite. I've had people from all corners of the earth reaching out, I believe more so than normal, to say, how can we A, help Darren? How can we help accelerate his time to effectiveness? How can we make him feel like he's part of the family? And there's been a ton of investment in helping parents with childcare. And I don't mean sort of money and time. I mean giving them activities to keep them engaged, how we can work on parents, you know, work-life balance and mental health. And truthfully, I think a lot of that was probably around pre-COVID, but it's really been invested in even more, doubled down on even more during these times. And so I feel very fortunate that I'm in a firm that recognizes that each of these areas I just mentioned, ultimately you get a return from them, right? Whilst Google doesn't say, I'm going to give you food in the office, or I'm going to give you advice around mental well-being because I want to make some money, you do get a return because you get enhanced engagement, you get enhanced loyalty, you get enhanced productivity. And so I love the fact that I benefit from this, but I very clearly see how it benefits the company. And by doing this, there's a return on it. And so, you know, my advice to companies and customers I talk to is, you know, don't underestimate the cultural aspects of getting this right. Because if you have an engaged employee, when they talk about your firm to people around the dinner table, it's a different conversation. When they come to work, they go to bat for you. They believe like they're owners and they're trying to make a difference. And so I feel very fortunate to be part of that within Google. But we've got to continue to do more. We've got to continue to challenge ourselves to be even better around collaboration. And I remember Sundar, our CEO, saying that a lot of the activities we do are unaffected during these times. But when we're trying to do new things, when we're trying to do big transformative things, whether it's for a customer or internally, they're really challenging during these times because we can't get around a table together. And what might have taken a few hours or a few days is taking us weeks and months. And we're not immune to that as well. So we have to be patient. We have to think long term about these things and not get distracted. And, I'm also a big believer. I tell my team, we have to remember that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and allow ourselves times to unplug and recharge and do things for the family and for ourselves, because when we do that, we come back stronger, we come back revitalized, and we need that. I want that, and Google needs that, and every firm frankly needs it, whether they realize it or not. And so I tell people, like, you need to proactively manage your day and manage your mental well-being and unplug. Really unplug, because when you unplug and take the time and do something else, you'll come back stronger. I guarantee it every time.
This is brilliant advice and really a great way to close out this program as well. So I want to thank you, for coming on to this podcast. You gave us so much insights as a Googler and also a digital transformation expert. You told us so many great things about your company culture, your hot takes on digital banking and customer experience. So you're here to help businesses, especially in Asia, right, and China and Japan, to navigate these challenges, especially posed by COVID-19. So to our audiences who are tuning in Asia and around the world, who think that Darren should inspire and educate or consult or even strategize your business to win the digital world, you guys should try to reach him. Maybe tell us how we can reach out to you and hit you up online.
Sure. The easiest way is LinkedIn. I have a pretty unusual name, Thayer, Thayre. There's not too many Darren Thayers out there, so you can find me easily enough. And I love to talk about this. I've enjoyed this today. I'm not always right, I'll tell you that. So you can challenge me if you think there's something we can be doing more or differently. I learn as much as I teach any day of the week, and very happy to talk to anybody that wants to follow up on these topics.
This is fantastic. So thank you once again. Please keep yourself safe and take care of each other. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks. So ladies and gentlemen, that's Darren Thayer, digital transformation, head of digital transformation at Google. So to listen to more episodes, remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, on Spotify and Google. Search CMO Asia Podcast and you'll find us easily. And once you're subscribed, you'll be able to download and get new episode automatically on your smartphone, your iPads or your computers as soon as we publish them. And please don't forget to submit your reviews and your comments. It is highly appreciated. So I'll see you at our next podcast live stream where we have someone from Microsoft coming on to the show. So I'll probably update our CMO Asia Podcast Festival poster so that you can keep yourself abreast with who's coming on to the show next. And remember to tune in. And if you are, in case you missed it, always come check out on our social pages as well so you can actually have access to our replay. So I'll see you guys soon. Keep safe and take care of each other. Goodbye.